Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was in June of 1985 that the Plaza Accord would be signed in New York at the New York Plaza Hotel, bringing together the world's largest economies to intentionally weaken the US dollar and rebalance global trade. For those interested in knowing which global economies we were referring to at the time, it was France, the UK, the US themselves, West Germany, and Japan. The US dollar had seen a sharp increase leading up to this particular gathering, and it was taken as a decision to intentionally devalue the currency. What an interesting time in history. I'm Jimmy Moya. This is the SFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest from the PIC. Last week, we took a look at the Public Investment Corporation's unlisted portfolio and the performance of that portfolio. To date, some 88 billion rand invested in a little over 15 companies with very little return on investment to report. We are speaking to the PIC themselves, the acting head of unlisted investments, in response to that, to get a sense of what has been unfolding at the Public Investment Corporation related to that portfolio and what we can make sense of there. Then we've got a conversation with the Association for Meat Importers and Exporters of Southern Africa, taking a look at the challenges and delays they are facing in looking to export some of their meat products into the rest of the world. We try and see if we can make sense of that before we have a conversation with the South African Reserve Bank on the latest issuances by the South African Mint. We have some commemorative coins that will be hitting the market and becoming part of legal tender in South Africa effective tomorrow. We're going to take a look at those. So if you do see new coins in the shops, don't be alarmed. This is from the South African Mint, and it is very, very intentional. We've got a conversation taking a look at how small businesses have been able to survive from the perspective of Lula. They've put together a small business pulse report. We're going to take a look at that report and see what it suggests about the state of some of the small businesses in the country. Before we wrap things up with a digital drive conversation, taking a look at cyber vulnerabilities that exist in South Africa and what we can do about them.
The day's markets. Understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show, with a sense of market movements throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, Makwe Masilela, to take a look at markets, see if we can make sense of them. Dr. Masilela, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A green day across the board, but I think part of the big surprise was the massive move in Tokyo. The Nikkei was up almost 5% on the day's trade. We'll get into that. I want to get your thoughts on that, actually, as a starting point before we get into the oil conversations and the peace deals that have been making the rounds.
Remember, Jimmy, and thanks for having me. Bank of Japan, they are supposed to be making an interest rate decision sometime this week, and people are already thinking that guys will just have to start maybe looking into increasing interest rates. I mean, what do you call it? Leave interest rates where they are because of this whole thing about the inflation. But generally, most markets, not just the Japanese markets, but including the European markets and our markets, have been lagging the US markets, and mainly because not having a decent exposure to AI, because we're worried about interest rates increases, and also because we're too worried about the oil price uncertainty. Remember, the US, because they are a net exporter of oil, they didn't have to worry much about that, even though we've seen those high oil prices already reflecting on the inflation numbers.
Marco, let's look at those oil prices. You mentioned the U.S. being a net exporter of oil. I saw a statistic that said that of late, the U.S. is a greater exporter of oil in the world than Saudi Arabia is, and that's quite an interesting number. But looking at the oil price back at $82.50 a barrel, we have not seen this level since March of this year, since we broke out above this level. The war tensions clearly driving that oil price, and we know that the result of those peace talks, wherever they may stand at this stage, is something the market has clearly evidenced that they've been waiting for.
Definitely, Jimmy, a pickup in energy flows will definitely help unwind the premium embedded when it comes to crude prices, offering comfort to policymakers battling inflation. And as you are saying, I mean, oil prices are sinking on that potential US-Iran deal. And the most important thing is that the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. We know energy infrastructure has been damaged. We know there's a blockade. We don't expect oil prices, the flow thereof, I mean, oil itself, the flow thereof to be to go back to where it was in February. But we know market participants are forward looking for the fact that we know that this is happening. The backlog might still take some couple of weeks, whatever it is, but we will know that at least something is moving. Hence, we see this kind of reaction. And can they still go down? I think they can. The problem here is come Friday, if maybe this whole thing doesn't come to fruition, not forgetting that Trump himself doesn't have a great track record of lasting deals, especially in the Middle East, but hopefully this one will last.
That is always the hope, and that is always the reality that we have been confronted with since the second administration of President Donald Trump. We'll see if that deal holds. Marco, I want to get a sense of the SpaceX IPO, and if you caught that on Friday, it was all the hubbub over the weekend. Going into Friday, ahead of that trading, we knew we were going to start at least $135 a share. We opened at $150. We got as high as north of $250 a share, but we closed out at $165 a share. What do you make of that IPO?
You know, it shows that there's still appetite. As we're talking now, I'm watching it, it's up 10%, and all because they think Starlink will be a great player. We know that their metrics or the expectations, you know, are very rich, and it's just price for perfection. But market participants are hopeful. And remember here, you also have some retail investors who are part of this whole thing. But it's just a cute, a nice spread, given that even institutional investors, because they even had to opt for a green shoot, you know, because of this whole thing that it was oversubscribed. So if people believe that this thing will still go up, who are we to go against it? But I think up until they get those numbers and get the return on equity, then those high valuations will definitely be justified. But as it stands, people are happy with the hype.
Marco, let's take a look at local markets. They are having a good day as well. Resource stocks up more than 6%, obviously a lot to do with those Middle East tensions simmering down, but by and large a lot of positivity returning into our commodity spaces. It's evident in the commodities prices and where the commodities are trading. Do you think this momentum will hold if we do indeed see a deal before the end of the week?
Yeah, because generally, Jimmy, interest rate hikes bets have been reduced, including ours. And we know the focus this week is squarely on that US Bank of Japan and Bank of England interest rate decisions. But people expect them to leave them unchanged. The point here is inflation worries are lessening, and that worked in favor that the global economies will do great. Remember, it's good news, you know, when it comes to this potential deal. And that's for both consumers and companies feeling the crunch of skyrocketing energy prices. So if we expected that oil prices, which we thought will have a damper when it comes to the economy, that that's not going to happen, then we expect commodity prices to continue to firm up, and that will definitely boost our market, given that we are relying more on resources, including industrials. So even just today, we've been driven mainly by our resources stocks.
A busy week potentially ahead for the markets as markets return, with the optimism that the tensions in the Middle East will finally come to an end. Only time will tell. We know, as Marco alluded to, that the United States does not necessarily have the best track record of being able to follow through on these conversations. But we remain hopeful. We remain optimistic. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Chief Investment Officer at Marco Fund Managers, Marco Masalela, joining us to take a look at markets.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So last week we spoke to Kaya Sitole of Karuska Consulting around the 88 billion rands worth of PIC funds that had been put into a little over 15 unlisted investments that had failed to realize a return on investment. We're going to be taking a look at this conversation from the perspective of the PIC. I'm joined on the line by the acting head of unlisted investments at the Public Investment Corporation, Zama Kanyile, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Zama, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start the conversation with an overview of the world of unlisted investments from the perspective of the PIC.
Fantastic. So as you know, Jimmy, the unlisted investments forms part of the bigger portfolio of assets under management that the PIC manages. At the last check, this was sitting at around 3.7 trillion South African rands invested across a number of asset classes, the biggest of which being largely the listed space, with unlisted investments comprising about 4% of that, and the unlisted investments that we talk about today making up just under 2% of that overall asset under management of the PIC. And whilst it is a smaller part of our broader assets under management, we see it as a critical play for us to be able to drive both sustainable returns for the providers of the capital that we invest, and also development outcomes that, you know, are tangible and that the members and the contributors of the monies we manage can feel in their various communities.
Zama, you touched on sustainable returns, and I guess this is probably where this conversation stems from, is these particular investments in the unlisted portfolio that we are looking at, the 88 billion rands over 15 companies, have failed to realize any return on investment. Now, very clearly, I want to just remind our listeners out there that, of course, you were not the head of unlisted investments at the time these investments were made. You've only recently stepped into this role, and so these are not decisions you would have had upon in making. But I want to get your thoughts on how then the PIC measures return on investments in an ideal scenario.
Sure. So the return on investment is stipulated in what we refer to as our mandates. So those are instructions from the providers of our capital as to where and how we should be investing that capital. And those providers of capital will outline that they want financial returns, but they also want to see developmental outcomes like transformation and like socioeconomic improvement as part of the key matrices that they look at. So the providers of our capital are concerned with both the dual mandate around returning the capital, but also making sure that we create jobs in a sustainable manner. We are pushing for boards to be transformed and include Black people and women, similarly to see that filtering down to management level as well, so that from an ownership to a management perspective, we are assisting in transforming the economy.
Now, some of these results obviously have no numerical or financial value that can be attributed to them. But Zama, I do want to take a look at the particular set of companies that were mentioned or that are in question here around how those companies have added value in their respects. Surely, from a PIC perspective, you've been able to measure some form of return, whether it is financial or otherwise. How is the PIC seeing the portfolio as it currently stands and the almost 90 billion rand that's been invested in these companies?
Yes. So, Jimmy, the listeners would have read some of the articles that we provided or were covering some of our responses to Parliament, where we covered the IRRs that are positive, that have been yielded over the whole portfolio, which means that we were able to return the capital invested plus additional returns in addition to that. And I think it's important to, while we are concerned around the lessons learned, examples that have been listed of the 15 transactions in the media, that we take a portfolio view. And out of that portfolio, you know, we're actually proud of bigger transformation stats and socioeconomic development measures. We've been able to support, you know, 37 hospitals, 3 clinics, over 4,400 hospital beds altogether. We've been able to support more than 23,000 student beds. And we know that supporting the next generation of our leaders means that we are providing both decent university education, but also making sure that those students are enabled to flourish in their space. Not mentioning the fact that we can actually account for over 200,000 jobs that have been created directly as a result of this unlisted investment portfolio.
Zama, you mentioned having learned some lessons from these investment decisions, and I want to get a sense of how these lessons then start to impact how the PIC looks at its portfolios. Obviously, as the acting head for unlisted investments, you might only be able to speak to the unlisted side of the conversation, but the broader sense of how the Public Investment Corporation, as the largest public asset manager on the African continent, then has to balance their own mandate of achieving returns and being the custodian of funds with not being afforded the same amount of grace to get things as wrong as perhaps other investors might.
Sure. So the issue of lessons learned is, you know, the cornerstone of any investment house. As you make investments and see them through their life cycle right up until exit, you draw lessons that then further improve what you do going forward. And I think it's important to draw almost a line in the sand between the legacy portfolio and the new portfolio that we're currently deploying against. And some of the lessons learned have been around, you know, tighter due diligence process to make sure that we're making the right investment decision, given the information at the time, making sure that we have value creation plans at the time of investing into transactions, and we've got a clear path to cash flows and are active in supporting how those businesses generate those cash flows to make money for the providers of the capital, but also making sure that we have sustainable development returns flowing from that money being active in the market. And that is overlaid by our strong governance processes that have been put in place. And a testament to that shift towards better, call it due diligence discipline, is that in 2022, one of our biggest clients, after all the internal reviews and the lessons learned and going back to the drawing board, actually allocated additional funds to us, which we are in the process of deploying. And I'm proud to say that of the new investments that we've made, we've only had one that has resulted in payments.
We may not always get it right from an investment point of view, but isn't that the nature of investments? If we all knew how investments would work out, it would be very difficult to potentially achieve some of the returns that are achieved. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Acting Head of Unlisted Investments at the Public Investment Corporation, Zama Kanyile, joining us to take a look at that unlisted investment portfolio that sits within the PIC, what they've invested in, what lessons they've learned from it, and how it is that that portfolio is moving forward.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, we know that the Department of Agriculture has been on a concerted drive and effort to unlock new markets following the uncertainty that resulted in South Africa potentially being removed from the AGOA agreement following the return of President Trump to the White House. This has resulted in many adjustments and decisions being made and many new markets being accessed. Despite this, there are certain markets that remain inaccessible, and that's partly due to some of the hiccups and bottlenecks that still exist. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters of Southern Africa, Paul Matthew, who joins me on the line now to take a look at how the meat industry is faring here. Paul, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Give us a sense of the parties or the meat exporters that you represent and how they have been seeing the market and how they've been faring in the market.
Yeah, Jimmy, good evening. Thank you for having me. So our members who do the exports in the red meat, and I think we just need to separate what is happening between the AGOA agreement and opportunities that we have to export up into the UAE market. Basically, what we have done is reached out to the Minister of Agriculture, who recently last week said that, you know, Italy once again is so keen for our red meat. Our biggest problem is that he is sort of telling everyone that these markets are opening, but we cannot get markets open. So it just seems to be a real bottleneck with the agricultural department. We've already seen UAE, we've seen Dubai, we've seen Qatar have been closed for so long. Obviously, we did have a FMD issue that has been resolved from these countries who have basically said, we want your product, we want your meat, but we just cannot get the government locally to open those markets.
Now, Paul, when you say you can't get the government locally to open those markets, what do you mean by that? Surely we have agreements in place, guidelines on how these exports work. What do you mean when you can't say you can't get the markets opened?
100%, Jimmy. So there are health certificates that are in place to obviously for us to export and import into various markets. There are usually structured regulation that we have to follow. FMD has played a role, but these other countries are saying, listen, we accept the vaccinated, let's say, beef or the lamb hasn't been affected, but lamb or goat that we export up into the UAE side. Recently, we saw that one of our big producers has just got Jordan opening that we are now sending beef to. But in a nutshell, these countries are saying we are ready. We will accept the product. Obviously, as South Africans, we have the product, but it's bureaucratic, technical bottlenecks with the government themselves in the agricultural sector who are delaying. And the delay could be many reasons. It could be, obviously, the excuse we always get that it's their own resources, they don't have enough people to do the work. But they're not getting the markets open. So we would liaise via the embassies with the trade advisors in these various countries. They say, listen, we have done everything. We've sent information into your government. We haven't heard from them. We follow up with the government. They have an excuse. They haven't heard, say that they tell us they haven't heard from the various countries. So it becomes a back and forth in terms of who said what. In this country, the provinces have the right through the state vets to export. So the provinces don't want to export because National hasn't advised them. So there's this whole internal communication between head office and the provincial side of things. There's no communication coming back to us as industry. So you can just imagine it's stagnating. It's just going in circles and we're just not making progress. And then you have the minister announcing publicly saying, oh no, these countries are very interested in our product, but we cannot get the product out. So that's what we are sort of putting out there into the consumers, so the consumer knows what's going on.
Paul, can we take a look at the impact this is having on the organizations that you represent and on business or the meat industry in general? If we're not able to export this, obviously there is a portion of demand that is met by local producers, but there's also a portion of the local producers' output that relies on the export market.
Absolutely. So export, obviously, of those prime cuts is prime to the members and to the producers of Africa. So yes, you're always going to get more for your product if you export. The benefit of that is that it helps control the prices for the South African consumer. So the more we export, the better we can keep the local price in check. So if you want to look at it in rands and cents and you have a look at how we've been fighting to get Qatar open the last 2 years, just on the export of lamb, so we send chilled lamb into Qatar, where we used to. We've been talking about that for 2 years. They are saying on their side, we're ready to accept your lamb, but we cannot get that health permit open from our guys to exports. So the producers are now sitting with product or with lambs that should be in that market. Obviously, that comes back into the South African market. It becomes a bit of an oversupply, but the producers lose so much due to the fact that they're not getting that prime value for that product. So it starts having a huge impact on the producers, back onto the farmers, back onto jobs. So, you know, one can just carry on. So it's very important that we have a strong stream of exports, especially on our red meat side, that goes into the rest of the world.
Now, Paul, we can do our part to support the association in whatever way that we can. From our side, there isn't much that we can do other than reiterate the message that you are getting across. If we were to deliver one message on behalf of the association and its producers to the Department of Agriculture, what would you want the Department of Agriculture to do to remove these bottlenecks?
So, Jimmy, I did have dialogue with government last week, Thursday. In fact, it was fairly positive. So I'm hoping to see some some results out of that. But I think a strong message is that South Africa has world-class farmers. We have good producers. We have the exports. We have the logistic providers. What we don't have is the demand for the problem, for government to fix the problem. There's no urgency that side. So we would push and say they need to look at this as urgently, so that we have the situation where we can export product out into these various countries that actually are sitting there and wanting our good red meat.
The red meat market is finding it difficult to unlock new markets, despite the fact that we have been on a very intentional drive to access new markets from an agricultural perspective. We'll hope this changes. We'll hope that the association and other associations do indeed receive the feedback that they so desperately require from the government and they're able to move forward. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Association of Meat Importers and Exporters of Southern Africa CEO Paul Matthew joining us to take a look at the challenges facing their market.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
The Property Pod, hosted by me, Suren Naidu, is South Africa's premier property investor podcast. On this weekly MoneyWeb show, we gain insider insights from leading executives, analysts, developers, and entrepreneurs in the country's dynamic real estate sector. The podcast features diverse guests and offers in-depth coverage on the South African property scene, also featuring as a video on MoneyWeb TV on YouTube. Listen to the Property Pod weekly on moneyweb.co.za, podcast platforms like Iono, Spotify, and Apple Podcast for the latest industry insights and developments.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Have you ever walked into a retail outlet and received change that looked unfamiliar? I've had that happen to me, and I've often wondered, when did this money start to come into circulation? Why does it look so different? And whether or not it can be trusted. The beautiful thing about living in the country of South Africa is that we have two organizations, one in the South African Mint that gets its directive from the South African Reserve Bank that will very quickly let us know what is considered legal tender in the country and what is not. And given that tomorrow is Youth Day, there is a special surprise from the South African Reserve Bank and the South African Mint to introduce commemorative coins that celebrate the history of our country. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with SARB executive Pradeep Maharaj. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Pradeep, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start perhaps with the decision by the South African Reserve Bank and the South African Mint to issue these new commemorative coins. What led to this and what are we celebrating here?
Thank you, Jimmy, and great to be on your show. Money is the foundation of our economy and serves three purposes: unit of measure, store of value, and a trusted means of transacting and exchanging value. In doing that, we produce coins and banknotes, and from time to time, we then look at commemorating specific events through our coin series. Of course, June is a huge month this year. It is 125 years since Charlemagne Ntuleke graduated as the first Black African woman out of a university in the United States. 50 years ago, we had the Soweto Uprising, which we commemorate tomorrow. And then, of course, this year is also 30 years of the existence of our constitution, which was passed in 1996. education is a cornerstone of that in the Bill of Rights. And therefore, in June this year, we felt it appropriate to celebrate and commemorate these really seminal moments in our history as a society and as a country.
Pradeep, when we take a look at these historical moments and these milestones and celebrating them through commemorative coins, we get the sense often that some of the coins or some of the issuances of these coins are for collector's purposes, and I think there's a bit of a disconnect between what is collectible, what is legal tender, and what is merely commemorative but still allowable in the ecosystem. Can you please just take us through just how the South African Reserve Bank looks at that and what consumers need to know about the discernment between commemorative coins and collectible coins?
Yeah. So the very simple answer to that is collectible coins are very special coins minted in either gold or silver or color coins that people will collect and keep with them. In the same way that some people collect art, others collect vintage cars, others collect stamps. These are all different types of assets that people will collect. Collectible coins are exactly that. In the old days, we used to call it numismatic coins, right? They're very special. You have only about 1,000 or 2,000 of a special range. It is either in gold or in silver, in different weights, and some of them might be in color. Those are collectible coins. You can only purchase them through a dealer or come to the coin shop in Midrand at the mint premises. A circulation coin is the money in our pockets, right? And acts as a unit of measure. We measure value in 1 cent up to 100, and then from 1 rand going forward. So it's a unit of measure. And any legal tender links to that unit of measure and a store of value that you can use on a daily basis to exchange value or to store value and on a daily basis. So that's a circulation coin. Any coin that is minted in a 50 cent, 1 rand, 2 rand, 5 rand coin is regarded as circulation coin, irrespective of the images that appear on that coin. And so we'll always only have the face value of 2 rand or 1 rand or 5 rand or 50 cent, 20 cent or 10 cent, right? And so that's the difference. So any coin, and we'll produce them in large numbers to co-circulate with our normal coins. What we intend to achieve through this is that these are seminal moments in the history of our nation that we are commemorating. We don't want it to be limited to 1,000 or 2,000 people that can afford to buy it. We want everyone in South Africa to have an equal opportunity to enjoy this coin, but at the same time to continue to transact with them and pass on the story of the events or the people that we are commemorating on those coins.
Now, I bring this up, of course, because we have seen a rise in the amount of fraud taking place where it relates to collectible coins. And so it's important to receive the clarity from the coin issuers themselves. Pradeep, I want to take a look at something that you touched on around co-issuance. We're not saying that these commemorative coins are going to replace the current coins in circulation, but rather that the monies will exist alongside one another and that consumers and South Africans can enjoy the existing money that they know and love in addition to these commemorative coins.
Absolutely. And that they will have no value apart from its face value. So a 2 rand coin will always be a 2 rand coin. Today, 5 years from now, or 10 years from now. Clearly, 100 years from now, how rare it is and so forth will be determined by circumstances at that point. But, you know, 10 years from now, you come to us, will tell you that it's still only worth 2 rands or 5 rands. And that's all it will buy you at a till or at a point of transaction.
Pradeep,
value to that extent.
Pradeep, from a South African Reserve Bank perspective, from a South African Mint perspective, and perhaps this is just my curiosity here, does it cost South Africa more to issue commemorative coins than it does what we would consider, I suppose, in this case, regular coins?
The cost of producing these coins is absolutely no different. The material of the coin, the coating on the coin, the size, the dimensions, all are absolutely the same. It's why we use coins to commemorate events rather than banknotes. To design a new a banknote is a massive undertaking. To design a new coin from start to finish will take approximately 6 to 7 months. You then need to run a process through cabinet to get it approved, to appear in a gazette, and then we can produce it. And to produce a coin would take us a very short period of time. And so all we do is change the image on the coin, but which doesn't change any, you know, so when you go into a coin machine, it still recognizes it as a 2 rand or a 5 rand and doesn't have any, doesn't see it as a different coin series. So producing it is very simple, very easy, and costs exactly the same. The only additional cost would be producing the die to strike that coin.
It's quite interesting, Pradeep, that you mentioned that the notes in South Africa are issued differently and are handled differently, because that was going to be my next question around whether or not we could do commemorative notes and how that would look. But I suppose that would then also mean we would have a new set of problems to contend with in the fraudsters' world. Before I let you go, Pradeep, I want to get your thoughts around, obviously, some of these coins, or if not all of them, will be going into legal tender effective tomorrow. From a circulation perspective, when do South Africans expect to start seeing them in their stores?
You know, we produce these coins, we distribute it. Ultimately, it has to get into coin vending machines, to retailers that provide change, to banks that provide you with coins. And so the process of getting it finally into your hands will take some time. It's not in the least bit conceivable that tomorrow you go to some coin vending machine and you'll see one of the 2 rand coins having this image, or a 5 rand coin having, you know, that new image. It's almost not going to happen at that point.
It might not be immediate, but it is official as of tomorrow that the commemorative coins celebrating, amongst others, the 50th anniversary of South Africa's youth would be going into circulation tomorrow on the 50th anniversary of Youth Day. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note. SARB Executive Pradeep Maharaj joining us to take a look at the commemorative coins issued by the South African Reserve Bank and the South African Mint, and when we can expect those to make their way into our pockets.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Anyone who's ever run a small business or attempted to run a small business knows that the challenges that plague small businesses are often challenges that leave businesses almost feeling as though they're all constantly in survival mode. This time around, though, it seems as though businesses, particularly South African small businesses, seem to be stepping out of survival mode and into growth mode. It's nice to see that in 2026. We're going to take a look at this with the latest SME Pulse report put together by Lula that suggests that businesses are doing more than just surviving. They might actually be thriving. I'm joined on the line by Chief Credit and Capital Officer at Lula, Garth Rossiter, to take a look at this, see what you make of it. Garth, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Give us an idea of the SME Pulse report that you put together at Lula. What do you look at? What is the purpose of the report? How did this report come about?
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. Good to be on the show. So just a bit of background there. Obviously, a lot of people talk about SMEs. They talk about sort of the impact they make in on an economy and the impact on growth. So there isn't a lot of data out there. So what we found is we have a lot of data. We've got a lot of clients, and SMEs are our business. So we've utilized that data to look at everything from affordability across industries to turnover to growth to how they're operating effectively across different sectors. And we've used that to kind of build a report to look at what performance looks like or has looked like. And this was released in Q1. and what we anticipate going forward. So that's basically what we've done, and we think it's useful data since there's very little out there on SMEs.
Garth, tell us what the data says about the small businesses in South Africa.
Yeah, well, basically it says, as you mentioned up front, it's showing us that I think from in the last sort of 24 months, small businesses struggled. They struggled and with high interest rates, and as inflation was dipping, there was a big differential, which really put a lot of pressure on consumers' disposable income. So as those rates have started to come down, we started to see a lot more confidence in small businesses at the beginning of this year. So we started seeing a lot more demand from consumers, obviously sector-focused, depending on sectors, but we saw a lot of demand from consumers. We saw a lot of growth in the businesses and a lot of positivity around the future prospects of South Africa, alongside the fact that obviously things like load shedding seem to be a thing of the past. So there are a lot of factors which really pointed towards a positive sentiment.
Now, Garth, I imagine you're speaking to small businesses directly when putting together this report and getting a real feel of what is on the ground from their perspective. What are small businesses optimistic about at this stage, and what potentially has them still worried?
Well, I think, Jimmy, these things shift quite rapidly. So the report really focuses on what's the first quarter of this year. And I think what we've made the point of is that at the beginning of this year, things changed dramatically with the Middle East conflict. And obviously what that's going to do to inflation. So there's a bit of concern at the moment, and I think this is more recent concern around what that's going to do to inflation, and businesses have to start planning for that. So the positivity is really around everything pretty much at the time was low interest rates, low inflation. Really, the government really seems to know what they're doing and focused on small businesses. We saw things like the VAT threshold being increased, which was a direct thumbs up to small businesses, really, and giving them an opportunity to remove compliance. So there seems to be a much more structured and much more business-friendly sentiment out there towards small businesses, which gives them the confidence to invest. What we've seen in the last couple of months is obviously what small businesses have been through for the last however many years is the ups and downs of the market. And what we're anticipating now is probably more inflation creeping through. And I think a lot of our small businesses, where they initially would have thought, you know, I'm a small shop in Joburg, how does this Middle East impact me? But really, the fuel price drives pretty much everything across the country. So it is likely to drive inflation. And whether that's long-term or short-term remains to be seen. So there's cautious optimism now rather than sort of full-blown, we're just going to go and invest and grow exponentially. It's really, you know, let's look at the opportunities and let's be pragmatic about it. And let's invest in those little areas which are going to drive us growth in the long term.
Garth, how are small businesses identifying their opportunity sets at the moment? From the data, obviously, as you said, it does only look at one quarter, and a lot has happened since then. A lot seems to be happening on the regular if we are thinking about current developments. How are businesses using the information that is out there and perhaps some of the financial resources out there to better approach their opportunities?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. So what we're seeing on our side, and sorry, when I say the last quarter, it was up to the last quarter, so it's up to March that the report was, but it's over the past, the data's over the past number of years. So we've kind of seen this trend. So we've seen a lot of business confidence improvements across the sector, and where we obviously fill the gap is obviously we fund a lot of these small businesses. So we fund when they see opportunities for growth. That's where we get pulled in. So that's where we're seeing a lot of activity from small businesses. And where they're doing well is a lot of them are planning for the future. And I think that's the differentiator between a successful business and in this SME sector is giving yourself some optionality when it comes to funding. If you've got access to funding and you know you've got that access, it gives you the opportunity to respond. Because when things are tough, it's not necessarily the time not to be investing. It's the time to be investing in the right sort of opportunities, because you don't want to be investing at the peak when things start dropping. So you really got to manage those cycles. But having the optionality and access to finance is really what differentiates these businesses when it comes to cash flow. Because I think, as we all know, cash flow is what really small businesses struggle with mostly. So getting that right, I think, is really important.
Small businesses in South Africa are growing ever so optimistic around their conditions and circumstances and finding ways to improve their own conditions to ensure that they not only survive, but indeed thrive. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Chief Credit and Capital Officer at Lula, Garth Rossiter, for joining us to take a look at their latest Pulse report and what it says about South African small businesses.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
The Property Pod, hosted by me, Suren Naidu, is South Africa's premier property investor podcast. On this weekly MoneyWeb show, we gain insider insights from leading executives, analysts, developers, and entrepreneurs in the country's dynamic real estate sector. The podcast features diverse guests and offers in-depth coverage on the South African property scene, also featuring as a video on MoneyWeb TV on YouTube. Listen to the Property Pod weekly on moneyweb.co.za, podcast platforms like Iono, Spotify, and Apple Podcast for the latest industry insights and developments.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is Digital Drive time on a Monday. We're going to be exploring the world of cyber attacks, cyber security, particularly where it relates to government organizations. We know that the State Information Technology Agency, CETA, is primarily responsible for a large portion of the government's ICT infrastructure. And we have previously seen that their systems have come under quite a bit of scrutiny from the cybersecurity world. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with cybersecurity researcher Joel Cedros. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Joel, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. The number of government websites that have experienced cyber attacks of late seems to be growing, particularly in the South African context. We've seen on and off reports here and there. We've seen conversations around certain systems being hacked. What for you suggests that this is becoming a common pattern and only going to get worse for government organizations?
So what I did was, in the month of May, a report came out that said that a cyber criminal group has hacked CETA and SARS. And that is what actually prompted me to then go and look at the entire situation. So what I did was I looked at CETA's network and the amount of vulnerabilities that I found, both on and off CETA's network, was actually quite shocking. So as you said, CETA is meant to be the organization responsible for government's ICT. But on their network alone, we found that there are over 5,000 known vulnerabilities. And this is only across about 1,100 servers. So one in seven servers on the CETA network actually carries one known flaw on average. And that points to a very serious issue. And I then looked at it into more detail, and I looked at what we call critical CVEs, or critical vulnerabilities. And these are the vulnerabilities that are rated between 9 and 10 on the severity scale. And on CETA's network, there are just over 500 critical vulnerabilities. And six of these are vulnerabilities that appear on what America's Cyber Defense Agency calls the known exploited vulnerabilities list. This is the list of vulnerabilities that aren't just theoretical risks. These are vulnerabilities that are actively being exploited by hackers across the world. So I think CETA, as well as our government, we have a very big problem on our hands.
Now, Joel, we've received various reports from CETA in the past around the security or the state of vulnerability that their systems are undergoing. At some stage, we were told that the government departments host a lot of their systems within their own environments, and following that, we've been told as well that CETA is continuously looking to improve their own infrastructure. Where do you think these vulnerabilities pose the greatest threat to government websites and, by extension, to South Africans?
Right. So firstly, I know that in CETA's media statement, they actually said that their systems are secure. That's a direct quote from them. But somewhat ironically, the CETA website itself isn't even secure. It's running software that has been for years not supported. And so I think when you then look at it from us as citizens, from our perspective, I think we are all extremely vulnerable. And I'd actually ask a slightly different question. Have we as citizens been exposed to a cyber, or rather, has something like this happened already? Has there been a big cyber attack that has led to our data being out there? And we know it has. Status A was hit by a ransomware attack in March this year. And that cyber criminal group, I believe they were called XP95, they claimed to have stolen over 154 gigabytes of data. And so the risk, not just to the government, but also to us as citizens and our data, it's not a hypothetical risk. Government servers hold data that we as South Africans have to give to the state, right? The state has to have our ID documents. They need to have our deeds information. They need to have our criminal histories, things like that. And so if an attacker is able to get into those systems, that data can then be used to commit identity fraud, to do financial crimes, and much worse against us as citizens.
Joel, how do citizens protect themselves? How do government organizations and government institutions better protect themselves? We know that the government institutions have been saying they're going on a clear drive to improve their systems, but improvement when the data is out is a little bit too late. What preventative measures should be in place at this stage, understanding that we do live in a very digital world?
To be honest with you, Jimmy, I don't think we as citizens can protect ourselves, because the reality is there is information that we have to hand over to the government. And then unfortunately, this information goes and sits on servers with thousands of vulnerabilities. So the government actually needs to go and they need to start patching their servers. They need to take offline any system that carries one of these known vulnerabilities. And these vulnerabilities, a lot of them have been around for tens of years. I mean, one of the earliest vulnerabilities on CETA's network has been there since 2006. That is when Thabo Mbeki was still our president. Off the CETA's network, the earliest vulnerability was in 2007. So it seems like 2006 and 7 were the last few years that the government actually cared about our data and about updating the systems. And they need to go and they need to update their systems. But in addition to that, we need to really have a look at who controls the systems, who is responsible for the systems. So CETA claims that they are not fully responsible for the systems. And then the government departments go and say, no, CETA is fully responsible. So there is no accountability. There's no responsibility. No one is taking responsibility for what is happening on these servers. But the reality is they're going to get hacked. Our data is going to get out there. Well, the data that's not out there already. So I think Parliament will actually need to hold both CETA as well as the various government departments accountable.
Joel, before I let you go, I want to take a look at international best practice in the cybersecurity world. What can we learn that can be deployed in our own situation to better improve where we stand from a cybersecurity perspective?
Well, what we used when we did this research was a tool called Shodan, and they are like a Google, but they're not for websites. They are for internet-facing devices, servers, things like that. And what our government can start to do is they can use tools like Shodan to go and monitor their networks and to get notified whenever a vulnerability pops up. But in addition to that, they should be patching their servers regularly. We can't have servers that are sitting unpatched with vulnerabilities from 2006 and 7. It doesn't make sense. The people that are responsible for the servers need to regularly update the systems. I mean, CETA's website itself is behind by a couple of years. It makes no sense to not update a system regularly.
Protecting the integrity of the information of South Africans and of the South African government is the responsibility of all of our citizens, including those that work within government organizations. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Joel Cedrus, cybersecurity researcher, for joining us to take a look at cyber attacks and vulnerabilities that exist within our organizations and how to better protect ourselves.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the update for today, folks. If you've missed any of our conversations, they will be made available as podcasts, obviously, to catch up on. We will continue to unpack what seems to be moving markets this week. It looks like there is a lot of data that is set to come out, and markets are anticipating, obviously, that a ceasefire that will take or that will be signed off by the end of this week. Hopefully optimistic around that. For now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock. We are going to cross over to Greg Host and the SAFM news team for the latest round of evening news. They will, of course, be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, happy Youth Day for tomorrow and good night.